Welcome to Hallowed October, and this is Scott Wells with the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by our favorite online magic dealer, ThePerfectTrick.com. If you guys are looking to find a reputable dealer and someone who will also give discounts, if you buy anything over $25, you're going to get a free trick. And also, if you add the promo code WORD on checkout, you save even more. And that's all available over at ThePerfectTrick.com. So thank you, Eric, for sponsoring this program. This program, by the way, is now we're getting into October, getting to be a lot of fun because it's one of the busy times of the year, particularly if you are a bazaar performer or a mentalist or kind of do a little bit of spooky kinds of things, particularly seances and those kinds of things then as well. Another thing that's kind of interesting about the month of October is typically during the last week leading up to Halloween, we have Magic Week, which is often designated by either the mayor of your city or perhaps the state. Anyhow, it's something that is recognized as being National Magic Week. The Society of American Magicians has been working with that for a long time. So you might see about what you can do now that you have a little bit of time to get prepared and take your magic club or perhaps you or a couple other magicians to go down and see about what you can do about getting a citation signed by the mayor and some sort of publicity for yourself and for the local magic community by designating this as National Magic Week in your area. One last thing I'd like to mention about the month of October, and that is currently that Neil McNally, who has the Doug Henning Project online, where he posts daily updates about Doug Henning, is trying to raise money on Indiegogo, that's IndieGogo.com, for a new documentary. And he has several people that he's already spoken with, and you can see a brief video clip of some of the people he's talked to and kind of the direction of what he wants to do with this documentary. But it's a worthwhile project in which he, again, is trying to raise some money in order to get this off the ground, and he's already got a pretty good start on it. It's going to be going now through October 23rd. So if you'll just go over to Indiegogo.com and just do a search for Doug Henning Project or Doug Henning Documentary, you'll be able to find that. And it is a worthwhile project, and I recommend that you go and help support this project. And it looks like that what he's planning on doing is having this completed by the end of 2019. But as these projects usually go, it does take a lot of time, certainly, and it's really more of love than it is profit. There certainly, when I've talked with other people who are producers and directors of documentaries, this is not something that they do that's they think are going to be getting wealthy from by any means. So I would recommend again that if there's anything that you can do to help out, please go over and donate. And they have different kinds of perks also of whatever amount that you want to or are able to donate in order to help this documentary come to fruition. That you can have different kinds of credits and get a copy of a digital copy once it's out. Anyhow, go check it out, Indiegogo.com. So I always like to try to feature a few interesting things around the, if you will, holiday season or Halloween season. And we seem to have a lot of people who are interested in that, too, because my analytics show that we have a lot of people who download these podcasts whenever we do talk about seances and mindvention and mentalism and that kind of a thing. Anyhow, I was just talking with my friend Jamie Salinas, and he and I have been doing seances for a long number of years. And he was suggesting that I should talk with Paul Voudini over in the UK. And so I contacted him, and we set up a time and recorded this Skype call that you're going to hear today. And the reason I wanted again to feature this is because just to kind of get a little bit of a more of a flavor of kind of what's going on the UK as far as what they do with seances and how that the UK celebrates Halloween. Now, we have tons of listeners over in the UK, and so I know this sounds old to you, but it's kind of something new to some of the listeners in the United States and other countries perhaps as well, because I thought it was kind of interesting about how that Halloween is observed over there, and it's a relatively new thing in the UK as opposed to Guy Fawkes Day. Anyhow, we get into all that and more, but the interesting thing I think further about my conversation here with Paul is the belief system. I wanted to kind of get an idea of how that he presents his seances, and in his case, it as we get get into it, it is more organic. In other words, that it's something that either it happens or it doesn't happen. He puts people in the proper mood and really tries to conduct a real seance and trying to make contact and just kind of letting the emotions, the feelings, the whatever happen organically. Kind of interesting. So I thought it'd be a little bit different perspective to hear what Paul had to say. Another thing is kind of interesting to note is that he does not see himself as a magician. In fact, he says he's not a magician and really never has been. He is interested in the paranormal. So it's not really a conversation with a conjurer. It's really a conversation with a paranormalist. How about that? I also need to apologize, I think, on his behalf, on his side, that he had a microphone. And it sounded like he was moving that around the table from time to time, so you hear a little bit of a scraping noise. Or perhaps that may have been a specter in the background. Who knows? So that was messing with us over our Skype call. But nevertheless, please welcome our guest this week, Mr. Paul Voudini, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and it is the spooky Halloween season, which is upon us then right now. And in the past that we have, over Halloween, kind of had this as a special time, and I've noticed that a lot of in my analytics show that listeners really like when I report from the Mindvention. So they're very interested in mentalism. I know who tune into this podcast, as well as around Halloween, interested in the seances, because I've talked with other people who conduct seances and who develop these kinds of things. And I thought that let's go kind of outside of our normal coast-to-coast United States and go across the pond over to England, where I have then a good friend of mine then right now, Paul Voudini. Hey there, Paul. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I thank you for being available for this then right now. And as I said, Halloween is kind of upon us. And is that kind of a big deal over in the UK?
I don't think it's as big as it is in the US. When I was a child growing up, Bonfire Night was always the big celebration around this time of year. That's on November the 5th, which celebrates Guy Fawkes and his attempt to blow up the Houses of Parliament. So Halloween was never a big thing. That was always, we always looked to the States and saw how big it was in the States, but it was never a big thing in the UK. But over the past 10 years or so, it started to grow in popularity, and the shops now stock, you know, masks, outfits, costumes, items that kids can carry around with them when they go trick-or-treating, etc. So it's becoming more of a thing in the UK and sort of almost overtaking our more traditional bonfire night, the Guy Fawkes celebration.
Right. But speaking of Guy Fawkes night and all that, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, I know what it is, but I know there are some listeners who may not know what that is. I know that he was going to blow up Parliament, and it is something that precedes Christmas then as well. So can you tell me a little bit more about what it is?
Sure. It all dates back to the 17th century when Guy Fawkes and some other collaborators planned to blow up the Houses of Parliament. They wanted to do that because they were Catholics and they wanted to kill the king and the Parliament and instate a more Catholic based ruling class.
Okay.
But they were caught in the act. Guy Fawkes was actually caught underneath the Houses of Parliament in the cellars, with surrounded by barrels of gunpowder and literally just about to light the fuse when some soldiers came in and caught him. He was executed in the most brutal of fashions. They all hung, drawn and quartered, and so were all of his collaborators. And so to celebrate the fact that the Houses of Parliament and the King weren't assassinated, every year following that, bonfires were lit around the country. And as the years went by, the centuries went by, fireworks were introduced, and it became a traditional celebration where people have bonfires in the in their gardens or in local parks and let off fireworks, etc. And you know, have roast potatoes and make toffee, etc. And so it used to be a huge celebration. It's died down a little bit now. A lot of it to do with health and safety, because obviously every year there were kids who got injured from holding fireworks, throwing fireworks.
Right.
And people used to have, you know, bonfires in their back gardens. And, you know, the fire brigade would often be called out, you know, all night long, putting out fires and and rescuing people. Right. And so in the sort of 21st century, with our sort of modern sensibilities of health and safety, people don't tend to do that so much. And the fireworks are now illegal to be sold in general to, you know, from high street stores. So it's really sort of. It's not died out, but it's not as when I was a child, it was a huge thing. It was huge. Wow. But as I say, Halloween is tending to overtake it now, to be honest, here in the UK.
Now, what day is it, a specific day of the year?
Yep, November the 5th, whatever day of the week that falls on. Same as Halloween is always October the 31st. Right. Bonfire night or Guy Fawkes night is always November the 5th.
Right. So as far as the history of that, how did they know that he was down there? Was he reported or maybe have somebody?
I think it was an informer. I don't know. You know, I don't know the total ins and outs of the whole details.
Yeah.
But from what I recall off the top of my head, I think there was an informer. Actually, thinking about it now as I speak, it might even just been pure chance. I think there was just a patrol, you know, of soldiers, a militia. These are obviously the days before the police were established. I think it was just they just happened to be walking past, patrolling the cellars beneath the Houses of Parliament, and just happened to find him. So, like many of the things in British history, it happened by pure chance.
By chance, an accident.
We ended up ruling the world in the Victorian era by pure chance. We never meant it to happen. It's just nobody stopped us.
So, well, we took over Spain. We can go a little bit further. Let's keep going. You know, rule
right,
the
exactly.
High seas.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
nobody stopped
us. Australia, I thought, well, that fits. Yeah. Until the Boston Tea Party, of course, and then
then
it was like, oh,
wait a minute,
are we the bad guys here?
Yeah, wait a minute, the Americans are not kind of falling like everybody else has. What's the deal here?
Yeah, what's going on? Yeah, yeah, they don't like us.
That's funny. So going back then kind of to Halloween, so when you were a child, you, I guess, didn't dress up and go trick-or-treating or door-to-door and that kind of a thing?
Not at all. I remember when I was about 12 years old actually going out trick-or-treating, and there was nobody else out trick-or-treating. We were only doing it because me and my friends had seen movies where it was a big thing in the States, and when you're a child growing up in the UK in the 1970s, I always used to look to the States as this sort of golden, mythical land, you know, populated by Kojak and Starsky and Hutch and all the cool movies that I used to like watching. And so me and my friends decided to go trick-or-treating, and I always remember an old lady coming up to us and saying, you shouldn't be trick-or-treating, that's American, you should be doing something that's called Penny for the Guy, which is to do with November the 5th, Bonfire Night. Penny for the Guy is when you make, on top of a bonfire, on Bonfire Night, people always place what was called a guy, named after obviously Guy Fawkes. And it was old clothes and hats that were stuffed with a newspaper, rolled up newspaper, to sort of make the semblance of a human figure. And then that would be placed on top of the bonfire. So it was almost as though Guy Fawkes was being burnt again. That's what it was supposed to represent. Ah. But in the weeks leading up to November the 5th, children would make their guy. And then they would carry them around town, stand outside shops, and they would ask for a penny for the guy. It was a way of kids making, you know, making some money or getting some treats, a bit like trick or treating. And people would give, you know, would literally give you a penny for the guy. And so this old woman, I remember saying to us, you shouldn't be trick or treating. That's an American custom. You should be doing penny for the guy. So yes, we were the first in our area to do trick or treating. And now, of course, trick-or-treating is quite a big thing now. You know, I've taken my own kids out trick-or-treating when they were younger.
Right.
Yeah.
And so as it has grown here in the U.S., I'm saying as far as costumes and everything, that we have a lot of what we'd call these little pop-up shops. It'd be like in little strip malls and whatnot, where there will be Halloween stores that will be selling cheap costumes as well as all kinds of Halloween type of decorations and that kind of a thing. So do you have those kinds of stores that pop up just for like a month in advance like we do?
We do, yes.
Really?
They pop up for Halloween. They tend to pop up for Halloween and then sell fireworks for Bonfire Night for November the 5th. And then they tend to stay open selling Christmas. Then their stock changes to decorations, wrapping paper, greeting cards, etc. So we do have those pop-up shops in the UK as well, yes, that pop up around this time of year just to sell Halloween things. fireworks for Bonfire Night, and then also for Christmas. But that the Halloween stuff is also available in supermarkets and local convenience stores as well now.
Right. Well, same thing over here as far as those Halloween things being sold in supermarkets, et cetera. Once that the Halloween season's over, they close up. That would be a good idea or an addition for them to hang around for another month, since they've already got the space to just restock with holiday things, I would think, for Christmas. But we don't go that far yet. That's a good suggestion. I'm surprised. Yeah, we might be following you in that case. Somewhere down the road might have starting a trend. We talk about the fireworks and everything. Certainly in the U.S. we've got a similar kind of an issue, obviously, where there are some fires and kids, you know, going into the hospital, or I burned my finger where a firecracker went off in my hand before I was trying to throw it, you know, many years ago also. It does happen, but that's why that it is banned in the city limits of many towns. In fact, there are some states that ban it entirely, and then other we have these fireworks stands that are set up on the roadside, basically outside of the city, where that you can purchase them, and you're supposed to go out in the country and explode them safely. And they do have fireworks evenings, of course, our 4th of July, which you have 4th of July, but you celebrate differently than we do. We celebrate independence, but so do you from us, I guess. And so,
yes.
But the fireworks are something that little at a time, it seems like it's, I don't know if it's going away or, you know, big business, here or not. But, you know, certainly Halloween is then as well. And that was one of the things then, leading up to it. I know that one of the things that you do is to market Halloween shows or seances and that kind of a thing, in addition to creating a lot of your own things, which I know that you market, and we'll get into that a little bit later then too. But when it comes to Halloween, do you find that, do you have like psychic fairs and things that kind of lead up to that and all that?
Well, the psychic fairs tend to be year round. They don't just sort of appear around the Halloween time. They tend to be year round, although sometimes they may sort of base their publicity around the Halloween thing and try to cash in on that. But really, the psychic fairs tend to be year round. October itself is obviously for performers who perform anything remotely bizarre, magic or seance based. October will tend to be busier because suddenly everybody wants to have a spooky show. But at the end of the day, Halloween is just one day. And when I was performing full time, I would be working sort of year round, and Halloween and October was really just another month, to be honest. And for a lay audience, for lay people, for what I call normal people who are not in this world, obviously when Halloween comes around, suddenly everybody starts watching horror movies and wants to go and do spooky things. But for me, it was always a year round. I feel as though my year is always October.
Right. With that as far as the type of venues where you would perform, are they mainly or always in homes, or do you have like a place where that you would sell seats and people come to see the show, or what?
I've just started really getting back into performing, but when I was doing nothing but seances, which I did for several years, I would do a combination of events. A lot of the events were for events companies. Companies would employ me to go and run a seance night or a ghost hunt at a venue. So the company would book a stately home or an old rundown castle, and they would have caterers in who would provide food, and members of the public would buy tickets to go along. And I would sort of run the event for the events company, and I would hold a seance and do the ghost hunt, etc. But then I would also be doing my own events as well, where I would book the venue and then I would sell tickets myself. And then also I would also have the private bookings in people's homes as well. So really, as the old saying goes, have seance, we'll travel. I would follow the money wherever I got paid. I would turn up and perform. But I would say it tended to be 70% working for events companies, professional proper companies who used to put on events. And the other 30%, a mixture of me booking venues plus sort of private homeowners inviting me in to either do seances or perhaps tarot card parties, those kind of things.
Right. As an aside, since it mentioned, I'm just thinking about the economy in general, I guess, in the UK, that I know, like other places worldwide, the economy has been down, slowly kind of recovering. But Brexit has to have affected the income and the shows, I think, a little bit, because from what I understand, the people are kind of on hold wondering what's going to happen next March. Are they going to, you know, have a job or not? And what's our income going to be like? Should we hold back a little bit? Are you finding that that's affecting you guys a little bit?
To be honest, not really.
Okay,
to be honest,
to
I think, I think, even in the most uncertain of times, people still want to be entertained.
Good point.
Perhaps when times are as uncertain as they are at the moment, you know, around the world, perhaps entertainment is even more important during these times than they are when things are more sort of settled and ordered. So I haven't noticed any change in people's spending habits when it comes to events or the other things that I produce at all. So perhaps it's a case of, you know, fiddle while Rome burns,
right.
You know. Have right. fun while you can, because who knows what's coming next year.
That's right. You know, I've done some several shows for liquor companies, and I have asked them sometimes how their business is going. They said, good times are bad. People are always drinking. You said the only, as
yes.
you would imagine,
absolutely.
The only difference yeah. is of whether they're doing top shelf or bottom shelf, you know, what
yes.
they can afford, but they're still drinking.
Yes, absolutely.
So with the seances that you're doing, there are so many different kinds of different ways of how that you would conduct yourself, as far as whether that you would be a medium, or that you would be someone, who a spirit is talking through you, or whether that you are an investigator or a ghost hunter, or just a skeptic and trying to see what's going to happen. How do you present yourself in your seances?
Well, I always presented myself as somebody who was just the host. I was just the facilitator. I was leading people on a journey, and we would go on this journey together and just see what happened. I never sold myself as a medium. I never, fell into trance and passed on messages or anything mm-hmm. like that. I would simply hold a seance, and I would say to the people, I'm lucky enough that I've had the chance to do this for a living. Because it's something I'm interested in, and I've always been interested in the paranormal and the supernatural. And luckily, I've managed to find a job. But I am no more gifted than you are, I would say to the audience. And mm-hmm. what we're going to do this evening is just go on a journey of exploration, and let's just see if we can communicate with spirits. Who knows? And I would state quite frankly that my job was not to convince you that spirits are real. My job is not to convince you that there's no such thing as spirits. My job is to open that doorway so you can have a look yourself and decide for yourself what you think is going on, whether you think there's spirit activity, or whether you think it's all in the imagination, all in the mind, or whether it's a combination of the two. So I just let people make their own minds up. And I was very much just the guide and the facilitator that just sort of knew the path we had to take in order to have an experience. But I had no vested interest in trying to convince people one way or the other about whether spirits were real or not.
Right. My buddy Jamie Salinas and I, whom we do seances, that's exactly the way we present that as well, because we recognize that people bring certain belief systems to the seance, of whether that they believe, don't believe, they're not sure, they could be skeptics. But whatever we do, we're not trying to change their mind from one to the other, but just recognizing, hey, let's just kind of see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's the best way. That's the best way to do it.
In that regard, as far as I guess it might be kind of personal, but as far as your faith, I mean, I know that like in America, that you have a group. There are atheists as well, and the UK as well as worldwide. Are you a religious or a faithful spiritual person?
No, I have, like many people in the UK, I have no faith whatsoever. I was christened. I was christened in the Church of England, which is essentially Anglican faith, and would go to church on a Sunday as a child. But I don't know, to be honest. I don't go to church. I'm not a practicing Christian. I have no real faith in the Christian God. But, I may be wrong. Who knows? And I have my beliefs about spirituality. I have my beliefs about spiritualism, about whether ghosts exist or spirits exist. My standpoint with most things is that I don't know, to be honest. And I think it's a brave person who says they're 100% certain one way or the other. You know, there's always got to be room for doubt. So, you know, if there is a Christian God, then great. You know, I look forward to meeting him. I have a few questions I'd like to ask. And likewise, I don't know about spirits. I don't know about ghosts. I have had experiences of my own that I can't explain. So I'm very... I wouldn't describe myself as a skeptic at all. I would say I'm very open-minded, you know, perhaps too open-minded at times. But I'm open to be convinced one way or the other, which I think is a really good standpoint to have when you're a mm-hmm. performer working mm-hmm. in this area, just to say, you know, I don't have the answers. And everybody has to find those answers for themselves. I think that's a very personal thing.
Right. No, I appreciate you being open and candid about that, because I was wondering about how that you would necessarily justify one to the other whenever that, you know, somebody is having some sort of a religious experience or an emotional experience that may be non-religious or whatever, that how you might, you know, handle those situations. In that case, have you had people, I guess, in a seance that has broken down?
Oh yes, absolutely. It doesn't happen every time,
sure.
but you do get people who will believe, especially when you're doing working with the Ouija board, or what I used to do, which is called glass moving, which is very similar. You have an upturned wine glass with alphabet cards around a table, and it works in exactly the same way as a Ouija board, but it's just bigger and it looks more traditional, and it's easier for people to see what's going on. especially working in that kind of environment. I used to get often people would come to the event hoping that a deceased relative or friend would come through, even though that was never the intention of the event, that kind of communication was never advertised or promoted. People would come with that intention that they wanted to communicate with, you know, their father or mm-hmm. a son or something along those lines. And when I used to do the glass moving, that is when people would tend to have that experience, because it starts to spell out a name. And if the first initial is the initial of the person that they wanted to speak to, they would, you know, they would just start crying at the table, because they believed it would be that person trying to communicate with them.
Right.
And I wrestled with that for a long time, because to me that was almost getting too close to being a medium, mm-hmm. to sort of passing on messages from spirits. But I also knew it was a very powerful moment. You know, it was a very powerful experience for the person who was having that experience, and also for the other spectators, the other members of the audience who were witnessing it. I knew this was, you know, it was high drama, it was theatre. But I wrestled with it for a long time, and in the end, I decided I didn't like the idea of people getting personal messages during my events. And so I would deter that at the beginning of the evening, saying, "We are not here to get personal messages from people we knew and loved. We are here to communicate with the spirits that may be in this building or happen to be passing through while we're here this evening, but we won't be getting messages from spirits." And just by saying that at the beginning of the evening, it sort of knocked all of that on the head. Nobody started having personal messages right. just from right. me saying that won't happen. But yes, I've had people, you know, breaking down in tears, you know, talking to or believing they were talking to dead relatives, dead friends, and as I say, it was a difficult decision about how to deal with that, because I could see how powerful it was as a performance piece, if that doesn't sound too callous.
Right.
But it also concerned me on a personal level as a human being that. What was happening here might not be what these people were expecting it, well, were thinking it was, or were interpreting it as. So I decided at the end of the day to sort of deter that.
Yeah, precisely. We've had the same thing early on with our seances, and decided that, hey, in order to prevent that, doing what you had suggested as well, saying that we are not trying to reach someone that causes you emotional stress, basically. And in fact, yeah. like what Jamie would say when he would be trying to lead someone down there, you know, let's say for a living and dead test or something on the cards and the pendulum, et cetera, of saying that if you're going to write down the name of some loved one, someone who has passed but is not... was not particularly close to you, so it may not be a sibling or a parent or, you know, someone who was very close, but someone or a friend, somebody that you know of. It could be even a celebrity or, you know, somebody else. In other words, that just that way we're trying to remove it a step or two, because if it gets too close, it gets too personal, and you really do get the emotion. And that's not really what we're trying to do, certainly, I think, as a the host, I guess, of the seance. I really don't want to say a medium, but, you know, the person who's kind of leading the seance, that, it is difficult to kind of wrestle with that. Yeah, it makes for great theater, but it's almost like having a joke at someone's expense, you know, where that you're making fun of what they are wearing or something they said, and the rest of the audience is laughing, but this person feels bad. And the same thing here, that the rest of the audience, you know, is kind of in on what's happening with the emotion of that person. And I just don't think that that's right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the audience will be basically, you know, they're all strangers. They don't know each other.
Right.
And this person will be having this very raw emotional experience.
And personal experience. You know,
Yeah. And they will be talking to what they believe was a spirit and say all the, you know, the most personal, private things. Meanwhile, you've got, you know, a dozen, 20 complete strangers staring at them and sort of and watching this unfold in front of them.
Right.
And at the end of the day, it just felt too icky, for want of a better word for me.
Yeah. You know, many years ago, Banachek and I were talking about this as far as psychics and fortune tellers, and that when you're doing a psychic party and when you do it for so long and for so many people, you start getting some hits and some things just start to come. I mean, it just kind of happens, obviously, just like with anything else. You feel comfortable, you know what's happening, and you don't have to, you can depend upon certain stereotypes that are correct. And as a result, it may seem as if that you maybe have those powers. And he said, don't fall into that trap, because it's easy to think, you know, if you have three sitters and you're right on those three in a row or something, you're starting to think, hey, maybe that there is somebody speaking through me, or maybe I do have this kind of a power, you know. You have to be cautious
absolutely.
Of that.
Yeah. You do, yes.
And so have you had anybody who has then come to you afterwards and then say that they do want to have more of a personal experience and one-on-one kind of a reading?
It has happened where people have come and said, you know, can you come to our house and hold a seance? But I've always sort of detracted, because then they're sort of looking at me as if I was a medium, as if I can do this for them.
Right.
And I would always sort of say, no, I can't put you in touch with the spirit of your father or your mother or whoever. I don't have that gift. And I've had people, usually old ladies, getting very angry with me, because they've sort of in their mind they've said the spirits. I remember one old lady coming up to me quite angry, and she said, the spirits are annoyed with you because you're denying your gift as a medium. Uh-huh. you should just embrace it. Stop pretending to be just the host and embrace your own abilities, because you are a medium. And so at the end of the day, you can give all the disclaimers you want, and you can, you know, say this is what's going to happen and this is what's going to, but people will walk away with, you know, their own beliefs, which in a way is good. Let them, you know, let them leave with the same beliefs that they came with, and then you haven't altered any, you know, you can't be held accountable for having altered anybody's perception.
Would you say that spiritualism is on the rise over in the UK?
I don't think spiritualism as a religion in itself, sort of spiritualism with a capital S,
but it's certainly
true that the New Age movement is a huge thing. You know, people are looking around for, I think human beings are by nature spiritual beings. They do, you know, look to the sky and wonder what's out there. They do wonder what happens when you die. Is there such a thing as a soul? So, you know, human beings by default are almost designed to be spiritual. And so as happened in the Victorian era when spiritualism came to the fore, and has happened recently with the New Age movement, I think that often what happens is when there are great changes afoot, when society is, you know, is in flux, such as it was during the Industrial Revolution and the sort of more technological revolution during the Victorian era, and then also our sort of information revolution with the internet, etc. Mm-hmm. More recently, people tend to look around for answers, and they want some kind of not stability, but almost a rock to cling to that says, you know, there is more to life than this. You know, don't worry if you're concerned about the future, because, you know, there's something more that happens after you die. And often I think the more traditional churches, particularly in the UK, such as the Church of England, which is very, very conservative with a small c, very, very part of the establishment, and has real trouble sort of making changes and sort of advancing and becoming more modern. If people feel that the established religions aren't offering the answers that they're looking for, people will go elsewhere to look for those answers. And so the New Age thing is big over here, as I know it is in the States as well.
Right. Yeah, it seems that People from time immemorial have been looking for answers, obviously, and with the rise of spiritualism, you know, back a long time ago, I know that particularly, let's say, after the war, that people, widows had, were trying to reach their dead husbands, you know, who died in the war or whatever, and that was, you know, kind of what Houdini was doing, is debunking spiritualism, and he did a lot, I believe, to debunk that, but I was speaking with someone recently, and I thought that spiritualism as a religion had died, and someone said, "Oh my goodness, no! It is huge," and I'd forgotten how many hundreds of thousands, I guess, there are worldwide. I mean, it's still active.
Yeah, I think I know there are some places in the States. The names escape me now, and they shouldn't escape. I should know the names off the top of my head, but there are several sort of towns. I think there's at least two towns in the States that are solely populated by spiritualists. But in the UK, to see a sort of, I don't know that any spiritualist listening will be throwing things at their computer as they listen to this, but my experience is that to see a vibrant spiritualist community, really you would have to go to London. Certainly in the cities outside of London, the spiritualism tends to be held in drafty old little churches, you know, a dozen people on a Wednesday night, you know, sitting around listening to a medium doing readings from the pulpit.
Right.
And no more than that, you know, no more than that. So certainly in the UK, I can say without any question of a doubt, the sort of the heyday of the late 19th century and early 20th century is long past, you know, it's long past.
But when I think of the UK and some of the belief systems over there, you know, like spiritualism, I think of the Druids and Stonehenge. Apparently that's still a big deal. Is that something also around Halloween that people go over there, or is it only just whenever that it's a winter solstice or something?
Yeah, it tends to be the solstices that people go to Stonehenge and gather and go to other stone circles as well. And all of that sort of Druid kind of scene tends to sort of mix in with the New Age thing. So the whole New Age is, and again, the similarities with spiritualism are that it tends to be a hodgepodge of different belief systems, you know, different ideas being thrown together under the same umbrella. So spiritualism itself was a collection of people with different agendas, different ideas would gather under the umbrella of spiritualism. Likewise, the umbrella of New Age, of the New Age movement embraces everything from, you know, Druids, hippies, people who, you know, people who deal with people's chakras and alignments and sell crystals, etc., etc., all tend to gather under that umbrella of New Age.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, just as I said, it seems like that the UK have a lot of being there as long as you have, as opposed to us being only here for a few hundred years. You've been there for centuries and thousands of years, you know, that gone through a lot of different things and changes, you know, in faith and experiences and experimenting with, you know, one faith or religion or another. When you do your seances, you're saying you kind of act as a host, I guess, in a way. Do you ever do something where that you're going to be holding hands or have something maybe that is a dark seance? Have you ever done a dark seance?
Oh yes, I mean my seances are always we sit around in a circle, either sitting around a table or standing, and from a performer's point of view, the reactions that I get are always better from people standing in circle, and we hold hands and in traditional seance style. The seances that I've always run, for people who don't know, have always been ungimmicked, what we would term ungimmicked. So I don't use any I don't know if trickery is the right word, but I don't use, you know, I don't have any bells that ring automatically. I don't use invisible wire. I don't have any electronic gizmo set up to make things happen. What I've always done is simply put people in a situation, in an environment. We turn off the lights, we hold hands, and I call out to spirit and say, "Is there anybody here?" And encourage people who are standing in the circle to tell me what they're thinking, what they're feeling. And so there's nothing to get caught out on, which pleases me, because I'm probably the world's worst magician. So as soon as I start introducing tricks into anything, it all goes wrong. So the way I've always done seances is literally to put people in an environment, whether that's in a stately home, in a haunted house, or allegedly haunted house in an old castle, anywhere like that, or a graveyard, and we stand round, we hold hands, and I will call out to spirit and say, any spirits around here, please step forward and make yourself known. You know, can you make a noise for us? Can you touch somebody? Can you whisper in somebody's ear? And really what I'm hoping to happen is that I activate people's imaginations. And so people's imaginations go into overdrive and they will start to essentially, I believe, I may be wrong, it could be spirits, but I believe their imaginations start to misinterpret signals around them. And so they start to interpret everything as being to do with spirits. So if they feel something on the back of their neck, whereas normally in daylight, they'll just scratch the back of their neck and that's it. They don't even think about it. When you're holding hands in a seance and there's something tickling the back of your neck, suddenly that's a spirit that's behind you. So very much so. The seances that I hold are very traditional in that sense, that we will stand or sit around in a circle and hold hands and call out to spirits and wait for the spirits to interact with us.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you are in those environments, do you point that out? In other words, do you do a little bit of backstory in order to put them in the mood, so this way that they're more open and susceptible to those kinds of feelings, or I guess of all of their senses, basically, of saying, hey, that this is what happened in this building, or that we're in this graveyard and so-and-so had passed here, or whatever. In other words, did you start right into it, or do you give a little backstory to kind of put them in the mood before you join hands?
Yeah, I always always have what I call almost like pre-show, whereas we do some what I term experiments, to get people in the right frame of mind. So we'll do some experiments with pendulums. We might do some experiments with Zener cards, etc. I have some routines where somebody will be selected as being the most psychic person in the room, and they will attempt to send a message out to everybody in the room. And this is, again, all ungimmicked. You know, you talk about pendulums and say they're ungimmicked. We all know how they work, or we think we know how they work. Uh-huh. But, you know, there's no electronics to get caught out with. There's no invisible thread to get caught out with. And so I have a good half an hour of routines similar to pendulums that I will use to get people in the right frame of mind. And then we will do the glass moving or the Ouija board as well. And so the idea is that we start off quite gently, and everything's quite fun and upbeat, and we're playing around with pendulums. Isn't this weird? Isn't this strange? And then we move on to the glass moving, which starts to take a darker turn, so that when we come at the end of the evening to do the actual seance, where we will switch off all the lights and we will be standing or sitting in circle holding hands, at that point, hopefully, the journey has been such that people are expecting something to happen. They've seen the pendulum swinging. They've seen the glass moving and the messages coming through on the board. And so they're expecting that something will happen in the seance. So absolutely, I need to get people in the right frame of mind. I need to activate their imaginations and their expectation so that when we do hold the seance, the actual seance at the end of the evening, they're ready for that.
I was going to say, just like that, I had made your microphone move across the table. I can hear it scraping. So
there it goes. It's the spirits.
Yes, indeed. So, you know, I was going to ask you further about whether that you do use any kind of electronic equipment or everything, and you've already said that you don't. And the same thing with us, that we use some electronic equipment, but for the most part, it's very organic as far as threads and wires and music or whatever else that, might have another confederate or somebody to do something. But in your case, you don't use any of that. This is all just organic and something that you build up in their mind and just let it go whichever direction it goes.
I tend to, yes. I mean, I would be lying if I said I've never used any trickery, because sure, I have. But in the main, I would say a good 90-95% of all I've done has been purely ungimmicked and a case of let's just see what happens. The reason I do that is because I don't come at all from a magic background whatsoever. I come from a background of working from a background of belief. I used to be a complete and absolute believer in the paranormal and the supernatural. And I started working for the events companies in the first instance just as a tarot card reader. I used to go along, and when the guests were having a meal, I would go around the tables doing tarot card readings. And I saw what the other guys were doing with the seances, and I thought, well, you know, that's what I want to do. That's where I want to be. And so I got my foot in the door at the events companies and started doing the seances. And this was before I knew anything about mentalism or bizarre magic whatsoever. And it was only from performing for the events company is that I started to look around for books on performance and discovered magic and discovered this thing called mentalism and bizarre magic that sounded a bit like what I was doing and got into it then. And that was, you know, this is that was only about 10, 15 years ago. And so I haven't had that background of growing up in a magic club and being used to using gimmicks and tricks. And so I'm not very confident. And I've seen so many times other performers where they've had electronic gimmicks that work perfectly. They're practicing, they're rehearsing, the gimmick works, and then put them outside in front of an audience and the gimmick doesn't work because that's what gimmicks do. They wait, the electronics wait till you're in front of an audience and then they say, right, now I'm not going to work. And I've seen performers, performers on stage staggering around, and I've known that the electronic, you know, the electronic gizmo hasn't worked, and they're thinking, what do I do now? And I never want to be in that situation where I'm sort of reliant on something working. So I feel more comfortable working in a completely ungimmicked environment, because then I know there's nothing to go wrong, there's nothing to be discovered by the audience, you know, because I'm doing my seances, and it's to coin a phrase, it's very up close and personal. I've had people, you know, turning tables over after we've done the glass moving, looking for the magnets or the wires or the machinery. You know, people are silly, and, you know, people have literally taken my gear apart looking for the trick. How does this work? And I can sit back and go, you know, there's nothing to find. Whereas if you've got, you know, a Ouija board that has a motor inside it that makes the planchette move, or you've got a bell that rings, you don't want somebody picking that up and dissecting it, because they're going to find out how it worked. So I'm far happier working in that ungimmicked environment. The only time I've used a confederate is when I wanted to do table tipping. I've never managed to get table tipping to work by itself, completely sort of above board and with no outside assistance. So I used to run a Jack the Ripper seance in London once a month. It was a monthly event, and we used to do table tipping, and the only way I ever got that table to tip was when I had a confederate in the audience who would be at the table and would encourage the table to move, but that's the only time.
Right. Yeah, that's true, that you really don't want to depend solely upon any kind of a gimmick, whether it's going to be mechanical, electrical, or just organic. And I say even the strings can break and thread can break or whatever, you know. And so if the whole thing is predicated upon something happening or working and it fails for whatever reason, you can't be left, you know, standing flat-footed, you know, just on your back foot like that. So, yeah, I understand that makes perfect sense as to why you wouldn't. Now, you said that you used to be a believer in paranormal, but then you're not so much anymore, or what?
I still, as I said earlier, I have a foot in both camps. I was a complete believer as a child, and as a teenager growing up, I completely and absolutely believed in the paranormal. And I almost willfully believed in the paranormal, despite all the evidence to the contrary. I wanted to believe in the paranormal because it made my world more exciting. You know, it made, you know, a sort of a very average teenage life, it made it more interesting to think that maybe there were, you know, ghosts or Loch Ness monsters or UFOs out there. And I've always been a very creative, very imaginative person. So I grew up. But then when I discovered mentalism, I started reading books on mentalism and books by Darren Brown and others. And sort of, I don't think it's so true now, but certainly 10 years ago, it was the accepted norm in mentalism that you were a skeptic and that you presented yourself as either a body language expert or an NLP expert or something along those lines.
Right.
And anybody who came along, you know, in those days, this was pre-Facebook, I believe, but there were a lot of very prominent magic forums on the internet. And anybody who came along and said they had a belief in the paranormal was usually roundly sort of jumped on and told how stupid they were, etc., because it was almost a party line that mentalists would be skeptics. And so for a short while I adopted that, you know, the sort of herd mentality. I sort of went, oh yes, well, now I'm getting into mentalism, I'd better think that as well. But then I suddenly thought to myself, do you know, I think the world is, well, the universe is not a better place for there being no mysteries or for no belief in mysteries. Mm-hmm. I think my life is enhanced by having mysteries in it. And so I decided again that I wasn't going to be a complete believer in the paranormal or supernatural, because that would be silly. That would be naive. But I want to believe, as it says in the X-Files, I want to believe. And I think my life is more enriched by having mysteries, you know, for thinking that maybe there are fairies at the bottom of the garden. You know, it doesn't make my life any less rich for having some belief in the paranormal, or at least being open to that belief.
So rather than being a skeptic, you're on the other side as far as being very open to whatever happens.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got to the stage in my life where I've decided, do you know what? I don't know. I don't know the answers. So if elements of the paranormal or the supernatural turn out to be real, then great, fantastic. I'm not going to be one of these hard-nosed skeptics who sort of, you know, crosses her arms and tuts at everything and says, you know, how silly to have any belief at all. Because I think people's life can be enriched by having a bit of belief in something extraordinary. Obviously, people take that too far, you know, and you do have to keep your feet on the ground and be sensible, essentially. Yeah. But I think a bit of belief in some mysteries is no bad thing.
Well, you said a little bit earlier, kind of going back to, you had experienced a few things and seen some things. And so by keeping an open mind like this, what kinds of things can you share that you have seen, you know, like would make you have a belief in ghosts or some things that have happened during these seances?
I have worked in most of the buildings in England that are described as the most haunted building in England, and I've seen very few things that have made me question my beliefs, or that have freaked me out or scared me. I know that people on the events have had those kind of experiences, but from looking from the outside as a host, I've had very few experiences. I've had a few things, you know. I remember at one venue in York. It was an old house, and I had to open up the house by myself with this big old key. And I used to hate going in because it would be pitch black, and I'd have to run in and switch all the breakers on so the lights could come on. And I used to have to set up and wait for the guests to arrive. And I always hated that first moment of walking into the house in the dark, because it was such a creepy place. And I have heard, footsteps, you know, and there was a room that had a table that seated 13 people, so it was ideal for seances. And it was up these creaky old stairs in this rickety old house. And I was walking up the stairs, and I heard footsteps going around that table. I wow. can't explain it. There was nobody else in the room. The sane part of my brain was saying, don't go in the room. Don't go in the room. There's something in that room. But the sort of professional was saying, no, the guests are going to be here in 5 minutes. We've got to get set up. And so I literally forced myself to open the door, expecting to come across, you know, a specter standing there, but there was nothing there. So I can't explain that. I can't explain what made those footsteps. But the one experience I had was a long time before I was a performer. It happened when I was about 13 or 14 years old, and in a garden at about 9 o'clock at night. It was a dark night, sort of autumn, winter time, 9 o'clock at night. It was very dark. I was in a garden, and I saw the ghost of a bride as clear as
really?
Seeing. Yeah, absolutely. It formed in the middle of the garden. There was like a white ball of light, about tennis ball sized, floating perhaps 3 feet off the ground. And then suddenly this tennis ball sized ball of light broke up into ribbons of light shooting around the garden, and then formed the image of a bride floating above the garden. And I could see the folds in her dress. I could see the veil, and I could see her face through the veil, but I could still see the trees on the other side of the garden through her.
Wow.
And I was literally scared stiff. It's the only time in my life when that saying scared stiff has been applicable. My brain was shouting to my body to run, but my body was just locked solid. And for, it felt like minutes, but it was probably only 10 seconds or so. She just floated there and then dispersed again into these ribbons of light that flew around the garden and then just disappeared. And I turned and I ran and ran and ran. And I have no explanation for that. I cannot explain to you what that could possibly have been other than a ghost. spirit.
Have others seen that also? I mean, was that in a place where that others have said that these kinds of occurrences have happened? And
well, I was with a friend at the time. He was a year younger than me. So if I was about 14, he'd be about 13. He saw exactly the same as me. What happened was once the ghost, if it was a ghost, had disappeared, we both turned around and ran. And we ran home and we never mentioned it to each other. We never said a word to each other about what we'd seen. And then a few years later, perhaps 5 years later, I was talking with my parents and my sister, and we were telling ghost stories to each other, you know, what people have had experienced. And I told this story. And then my parents told me that this house was located on a crossroads near a church, that they remember a story of a bride on her way to a wedding at the church. The car she was in went through a red light at the crossroads. There was an accident and she died at that crossroads, which made me go, wow, you know, wow, there could be something to do with that. But then several years later, perhaps another 5 years later, I'd started dating a girl and we'd gone to my local pub. And we were sat at a table having a drink, and it just so happened that the friend who had been with me when I saw the ghost was stood next to us with another group of people. And I was talking to this girl, and I was trying to impress her, and I was saying, oh, do you know any ghost stories? And she said, oh, no, I've never seen anything. So I told her this story about what had happened when I was younger. And because my friend was stood nearby, I called over to him. His name was Jim. I remember I turned around to him and said, oh, Jim, do you remember that time when we saw that ghost of the bride in the house down the road? And he didn't say anything, but he just started to cry. Like, wow. That was the first time he thought about it in 10 years. And he just started to cry there and then. And again, never said anything, just turned back around and to his other friends. And we've never mentioned it since. Wow. I haven't seen him now for perhaps 10 years or so. Still friends, but we've never talked about it.
That's interesting. You know, you mentioned about using a Ouija board, but actually using the glass to move around with a clock dial of cards, basically. And in that case, you know, I've heard it said, as far as using a Ouija board, it's like making a phone call to a payphone to the other side, because you don't know who's going to answer. If you're, you know, you might be looking to talk to, you know, Aunt Emmy or whomever, but, you know, someone else might answer the phone or come in. It might be a good spirit or an evil spirit. Have you heard that before as well?
I've heard that theory. My personal opinion is that Ouija boards tend to get a bad rep. This is probably because of Hollywood and all the horror movies. And, everybody has seen some iconic scenes where Ouija boards have used. But if you're saying that a Ouija board is like dialing up the other side of the veil and you don't know who's going to pick up, the same is true of the seance where you're holding hands and calling out to spirits. You never know who would come through. And even working with pendulums, you know, you can use pendulums for communication. So it's not just Ouija boards. I remember not so many years ago in the UK, the tarot cards had the same reputation as Ouija boards do now. People used to say, oh, don't deal with the tarot cards. You know, they're a gateway to the other side. You know, it'll open up a gateway to let any sort of demons through. And you couldn't buy tarot cards in the UK. In the 1980s, the 1990s even, you couldn't buy tarot cards in the UK. You had to – my first pack of tarot cards were brought back from Spain by a girlfriend who'd gone on holiday and found them and brought them back. And I remember holding them in my hands and going, oh, my goodness, a real pack of tarot cards. dare we open them. Dare we sort of play with them.
Right.
So my thing is I do think Ouija boards get a bad rep. And often these kind of folklores, these sort of urban myths are good for us as performers because it helps people come with certain expectations of what's going to happen, which we can tap into, which is good. But I've never experienced anything bad coming through. And I've always, used to say to people, you know, if the Ouija board or the glass starts to spell out something strange, starts to say something stupid, like, you know, spell out Satan or devil or something, we'll just stop. We'll just stop and let that spirit. I say it won't be the devil that's coming through. It won't be Satan. You know, it will just be a spirit that thinks it's funny to have a bit of a laugh and a joke at our expense.
Right, because I would think sometimes you would have some of your guests or who are there in the circle as well who might be thinking that's we're going to have some fun. This isn't really going to work, and they're skeptics, and so they start pushing the glass to where they want it to go. You know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the times when I've seen people communicating with spirits of their loved ones, it's always been when they've had a friend at the table too. And I believe that either consciously or subconsciously, the friend has been trying to help out the bereaved friend by giving them a message of sort of hope. So it's very true that you will get people either consciously or subconsciously pushing the glass to pass on a message that they want, whether it's a joke and spelling out devil or whether it's to pass on a message from a loved one, for sure. But one story I will tell you very quickly is I used to do events where there would be celebrity mediums would come along. And there's a TV show in the UK called Most Haunted, which you may have heard of. It's one of the first ghost hunting TV shows. One of the mediums that worked on some of the later episodes, the later series, was a guest of honor at this event. And so I introduced him. He came out. It was in a big stately home in this big banqueting hall. And the audience were all applauding, going wild to see this guy from the TV. And he opened himself up to a Q&A session. You know, anybody got any questions about the paranormal, etc. And this lady put her hand up and said, how do we know when we go on a ghost hunt or we hold a seance, how do we know that something from the other side, something evil, isn't going to come through and attach itself to us, that we're not going to take an evil spirit away with us home after the event? And of course, this is the kind of ideas that people have, you know, that they worry about after watching horror films, etc., that, you know, some evil entity is going to attach itself to them. And then when they get home, they're going to start experiencing poltergeist activity, etc. And so this guy, who was quite a camp character, said, do you know, we're in this ancient house. This house has stood for thousands of years. And the spirits here have been here for thousands of years or perhaps longer. And then tonight, of all nights, they're going to follow you home. Get over yourself. Everybody laughed. And so I, at every event, I sort of recounted that tale again, just to dispel the idea that something bad could happen to you from attending an event like this, a ghost hunting or a seance type event. Because again, you know, the mind is a powerful thing. And if people get it into their minds that something bad can happen, then that can manifest itself. You know, people start, you know, in life, bad things happen, but you can't start blaming the spirits for it. You know, it won't be the spirits' fault. So I used to recount that tale to dispel any ideas that people might have about what might happen afterwards.
Well, you know, we have a disclaimer that people have to sign before they come in to see our seance, and we give them a copy of it, which is in the program, basically, and it has several paragraphs, most of which is we record these also, and they're kind of giving us the recording rights that we could post on the website. If something happens, you know, that we'll post it, and you're giving us your consent, et cetera. Mm. But that's kind of between the lines, or maybe just a small paragraph, but the rest of it really is kind of what you're saying there, that if for some reason that when you get home that windows break or your walls start bleeding or certain things happen that may seem to be ghoulish images or something that is ethereal that is not caused by something that you can explain, and you feel as if that spirit is following you home, that we are not responsible. You know, this is, you know.
Disclaimer, yes.
So we feel
contact your local church.
Yeah. So that's why the people start thinking, well, will they follow us home? Say, well, I don't think they will, but if they do, we're not responsible. We're not paying for any broken windows at your place if something happens, you know, or you have a car wreck on the way home. It's not because, you know, there was a specter in your back seat or something over there. Well, you mentioned about also Jack the Ripper, and Jamie had purchased the Jack the Ripper seance from you, and we have been doing that for years. And one of the things that we have, just he may have explained this to you, I mean, an email or something, but as an aside, is that one of the suspects who was believed to possibly have been Jack the Ripper supposedly had checked himself into then a mental institution, and then he got on a check back out, got into on a ship, came to the U.S. and there were some Ripper-esque style murders, I guess, that had happened over a period of years, and that in New York and Atlanta and Chicago. But one of them happened to happen in Galveston, Texas, so it's just south of us here in Houston. And the place where we hold the seance is a place that is the oldest bar, basically. It was there back, built in 1847. And so and also the prostitutes had worked this place as well. And so we are leading people into believing that it's possible that the suspect, who could have been Jack the Ripper, had come through Houston and perhaps had been at this very bar where we are right now, but felt that it was too busy, and so he went on down to Galveston where he found a victim. And there are newspaper reports and proof of all of this happening, not only here but elsewhere. But the police, of course, weren't connected back then. They didn't know about, I mean, he was the first serial killer and everything like that. So it's one of those things that really, you know, tended to work great with us. And also, whenever that Jamie got this from you, that one of the cool things he was telling me was that you said some of the proceeds you were going to use for buying a floral arrangement and placing it on Mary Kelly's grave, which you took a photo and sent that to him, which was really pretty cool too.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, I remember that. That I remember the day of going to the graveyard very, very vividly. It was a strange experience. I'd released the Jack the Ripper seance, and I said that what would happen was everybody who purchased the PDF would have their name put on a card, a sort of funeral card that we would place on the grave and the flowers as well. And Mary Jane Kelly is buried in a graveyard. It's not in central London, but it's in Leytonstow, which is an area of London. And I arrived there. I'd followed the sat nav down to London, and it had directed me to the graveyard. And I had expected it to be quite a small graveyard and to be able to find Mary Jane Kelly's grave quite easily. I arrived there, and there was this huge expanse of graves. And I had no idea where to start looking, and I spent half an hour just wandering around aimlessly around the graveyard, hoping to come across. I knew what her grave looked like. I'd seen photos on the internet of her grave, but couldn't find it anywhere. There was a small building that normally on a weekday was occupied by a small gift shop, and there were wardens who would sort of point you in the right direction if you were looking to a certain grave. But this was a weekend, and that was closed up, so there was nobody there to help. And I was holding this big bunch of flowers that I bought with me to put on Mary Jane.
Wandering
around. And so I just stopped, and I just looked up to the sky, and I said, "Come on, Mary Jane, where are you? Show me where you are." Because I'd arranged to meet some other mentalists in central London in a pub, and I was thinking, I can't just be wandering around here all day. So I looked to the sky, and I whispered under my breath, "Come on, Mary, show me where you are. Where are you?" And I just started walking, walked around a corner, and there it was. Walked straight into it.
Wow.
So that was a sort of bizarre moment. And I don't know if you know, but some of the listeners might be interested to hear that Mary Jane Kelly's grave to this day is always festooned with flowers, with small teddy bears, and with bottles of gin. People put little bottles of gin on her grave and little shot glasses full of gin on her grave. Mm-hmm. And I got there, and again, you know, there were other floral arrangements, etc., around the grave, and I put the flowers on the grave and the card, and I brought a little bottle of gin as well, so I had a swig of the gin myself, and then put the rest of the gin on the grave. And it was quite an emotional experience, to be honest. I hadn't expected it to be quite so emotional, but I think it's, you know, growing up being interested in Jack the Ripper, watching all the movies, and Mary Jane Kelly has always been that one victim that for whatever reason holds people's attention, and all people become fixated almost on Mary Jane Kelly. And to be stood there at her graveside really was quite an emotional experience, and something I'll never forget.
Well, yeah, as far as that picture, if you still have that available someplace, send me a copy of that, and I'll put that on the blog. So people
will. I will. Yes, I've got. I certainly have that somewhere. Yes, I will find that, and I will. I'll send that over to you.
Good. So I encourage people who are listening to this then now to go to themagicwordpodcast.com and to this particular episode, and you can and see that picture. Thanks for sending that. Now, when you've done this Jack the Ripper seance, have you had anything unusual happen? I mean, that seems kind of unusual right there, the fact that you just kind of looked up and then she told you where her grave was. But have you had other kinds of experiences as far as doing that particular seance?
There's always one that stands out in my mind was I used to tell the story of what happened with Jack the Ripper, recount the tale for people who didn't know all the details. I used to do some opening things with pendulums, etc. And I used to do a guided visualization, something that would later materialize in my book, The Midnight Side of the Mind, where I do past life regressions. And I used to take people on a guided visualization so they would imagine themselves being in Victorian London, and they would articulate, they would tell people in the audience what they're, I mean, this very small audience, 12 people, they would tell, what they're seeing in their mind. And so it's almost like astral travel almost. Uh-huh. And then we would have the settlement, and then we would have the seance at the end. And there was one time when I got the group, we were standing around in a circle holding hands and saying, we want to communicate with the spirit of Jack the Ripper or one of his victims or somebody from that era who remembers these crimes, who can communicate with us. And I'd split the circle up so that on one side it was all men and on the other side it was all women, often doing this kind of thing. You can encourage things to happen, break people up from their friends so they don't have that safe zone, and so they're standing next to strangers. So I'd made the circle, on one half it was all men and on the other half it was all females. And suddenly one of the men started groaning and moaning, and he started swearing and calling all the women calling all the women on the other side of the circle, all the names. I won't repeat the names, but he was calling them all the names, all the swear names he could think of, and he was talking in this voice like this, I hate you all, you women. And then the women on the other side of the room started to shout back at him. And they were calling him, so-and-so and all these other names, and telling him to bugger off. And the strange thing was, all these women who were suddenly sort of banded together in this sort of collective to protect themselves were talking in East End London accents. Wow. It was the strangest thing. And then after the event had ended, we put the lights on and everybody was sort of laughing and saying that was such a weird experience. And I even had one of the women email me after the event to apologize for her language, but she didn't know where the words were coming from. And she didn't know where this strange sort of East End London accent had come from either, because that wasn't the way she normally spoke. So that was a strange experience again. Did they really become, did the spirits really speak through them, or was it just that their imaginations have been activated and they were sort of imagining how it would have felt to be these women, who were victims of Jack the Ripper? I don't know. But yes, that's one that always stands out in my mind.
And have you had them ever over in Whitechapel, or have they been just other places?
I haven't, unfortunately. I used to have them in Covent Garden, which is in the central London, in what's called Theatreland. So it was a great place to have it, a wonderful location. But I did a private party once for a tea room in Spitalfields. And for those of you who don't know, Jack the Ripper's crimes were committed in Whitechapel, but also Spitalfields. Whitechapel and Spitalfields tend to sort of run into each other, like a jigsaw piece. It's very difficult to say where Whitechapel ends and Spitalfield begins. They're sort of almost synonymous. And I did an event, a private event, one Christmas for a group of co-workers who wanted to have a seance night. And in Spitalfields, there was this 1940s tea room. So somebody had sort of bought this building and transformed it into a tea room from the 1940s. And it was wonderful, very retro, great attention paid to detail. It was a wonderful location. And of course, Jack the Ripper didn't do his crimes in the 1940s, but the actual decor and the look of the place wasn't so different from how it would have looked in Victorian times, perhaps. And so we had a great night, and I was talking to the owners of the venue afterwards and said, I do this event called the Jack the Ripper Seance, and I'm looking for a new venue. I'd love to hold the event here. And they said, send us an email next week and we'll see what we can organize. So I emailed them and said, I'd like to, hold my seances here once a month. How much do you charge for rent, for hire of the venue? And they ignored my email. I phoned them and the boss was never in. He could never take my call. And in the end, after about a week of persistently emailing and phoning, one of the ladies who worked at the venue said to me on the phone, I don't think they want you to have your events here because they don't like the idea of having a seance at their venue. And so I missed out on having the perfect location for the Jack the Ripper seance. And I think I missed out on it by saying I was going to hold a seance. I think if I'd have said in one of my books, I recommend not contacting venues and saying you're going to host a seance if you want to host events yourself, but rather either call it a magic show or you're a Victorian historical society who are going to do a recreation of Victorian spiritualism. It makes it sound a lot more more safe than saying you're going to hold a seance.
Acceptable.
Acceptable, absolutely.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, as we start to wrap up, a couple of questions. One of them has to do with the kinds of things that you do have for sale that people might be interested in, as far as like with seance spiritualism, your books and whatnot. What briefly have you got or that might be available, and where can I get them?
Well, my website where I sell my PDFs for performers is www.readerofminds.co.uk, that's readerofminds.co.uk, and that's where I have all of my PDFs on hosting seances, cold reading techniques, Q&A, Midnight Side of the Mind, which is about past life regressions and visualization, etc. They're all on that website. You can also find most of them on any magic website, and they sell through Penguin and through Murphy's Magic. So go out to most retailers, you can find my work at most magic websites. Although, of course, I would prefer you go to my website because I don't have to pay fees to the retailers. If you, but of course, you know, wherever you can find them, that's fine. readerofminds.co.uk is where you'll find my PDFs on the various subjects we've talked about today.
Great, good. And then finally, Paul, because my podcast is called The Magic Word, what would be your philosophy of life? What is your, not necessarily
my philosophy of life? I would say do what makes you happy, you know. Nobody ever was on their deathbed, looked back and said, you know, I wish I'd spent more time, you know, working the office job or, you know, follow your dreams. You know, you only get, perhaps you only have one life, who knows? But if you do only have one life, then what a shame to not follow your dreams and to let those, you know, don't let those dreams die. Because I very nearly did, but I was lucky enough to fall into this business, and it has made a lot of my dreams come true. So to sum up, I would say follow your dreams.
Yep, follow your dreams and live happy. That sounds great.
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
Paul, thanks very much. I appreciate your time and your words over here. That sounds great. And I think a lot of people who are interested in this kind of a thing, they may want to pursue this. They can go and check out the website and download some of the PDFs then as well. But also the stories and things you've shared, that's been great. It's kind of interesting to hear all the background and some of the history, not only about Guy Fawkes, but what's happening with Halloween in the UK and some of the stories and all that. So thanks again for being our guest.
That would be my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, you bet. And so for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Paul Voudini, and this is Scotty out. Well, I want to thank Paul very much for being my guest this week and part of this Halloween month of October as we get ready and the countdown comes closer to Halloween. Actually, Halloween, of course, is going to be following on a Wednesday, which is the day before the podcast comes out. So we're going to be having a couple more Halloween or kind of interesting, bizarrely related conversations over the next couple of weeks. So if you like this kind of thing, we got a couple more that are coming up over the next couple of weeks. So stay tuned. Again, I want to thank our sponsor, theperfecttrick.com. Go check them out. And also remind you to go and help support Neil McNally and the Indiegogo.com campaign for the Doug Henning documentary. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and follow your dreams and be happy. This is Scotty out.